Blue Mars, Cassette 7. The room was brightly lit by a pair of giant spotlights pointed at the ceiling. The shiny floor was crowded. Tables, benches, machinery in all stages of assembly. Boat engines, pumps, generators, reels, things Nergal didn't recognize. The working generators were down a hall, though they didn't seem any quieter for that. Nergal went to one wall to inspect the bubble material. It was only a few molecules thick, Bly's friends told him, and yet would hold thousands of pounds of pressure. Nergal thought of each pound as a blow with a fist, thousands all at once. These bubbles will be here when the concrete's worn away. Nergal asked about Hiroko. Karna shrugged.
I never knew her name. I thought she was a Tamil from the south of India. She's gone over to South End, I hear.
She helped to set this up?
Yeah. She brought the bubbles in from Vlissinger, her and a bunch like her. Great what they did here. We were groveling in High Halstow before they came.
Why did they come?
Don't know. Some kind of coastal support group, no doubt.
He laughed.
Though they didn't come on like that. Just moving around the coasts, building stuff out of the wreckage for the fun of it, what it looked like. Intertidal civilization, they called it. Joking as usual. Hey, Karna Singh! Hey, Bly! Lovely day out, isn't it? Yeah. Care for some scrub?
The next big room was a kitchen, and a dining area jammed with tables and benches. Perhaps 50 people had sat down to eat, and Karna cried, Hey! And loudly introduced Nergal. Indistinct murmurs greeted him. People were busy eating, big bowls of fish stew ladled out of enormous black pots that looked like they had been in use continuously for centuries. Nergal sat to eat. The stew was good. The bread was as hard as the tabletop. The faces were rough, pocked, salted, reddened when not brown. Nergal had never seen such vivid, ugly countenances, banged and pulled by the harsh existence in Earth's heavy drag. Loud chatter, waves of laughter, shouts. The generators could scarcely be heard. Afterward, people came up to shake his hand and look at him. Several had met the Asian woman and her friends, and they described her enthusiastically. She hadn't ever given them a name. Her English was good, slow, and clear.
I thought she were Paki. Her eyes didn't look quite Oriental, if you know what I mean. Not like yours, you know, no little fold in there next to nose. Epicanthic fold, you ignorant bugger.
Nergal felt his heart beating hard. It was hot in the room, hot and steamy and heavy. What about the people with her? Some of those had been Oriental. Asians, except for one or two whites. Any tall ones? Nergal asked. Like me? None. Still, if Hiroko's group had come back to Earth, it seemed possible the younger ones would have stayed behind. Even Hiroko couldn't have talked all of them into such a move. Would France leave Mars? Would Nanidi? Nergal doubted it. Return to Earth. In its hour of need, the older ones would go. Yes, it sounded like Hiroko. He could imagine her doing it, sailing the new coasts of Terra, organizing a re-inhabitation.
They went over to South End. They were going to work their way up the coast.
Nergal looked at Bly, who nodded. They could cross, too. But Nergal's escorts wanted to check on things first. They wanted a day to arrange things. Meanwhile, Bly and his friends were talking about underwater salvage projects, and when Bly heard about the bodyguard's proposed delay, he asked Nergal if he wanted to see one such operation taking place the next morning.
Though it's not a pretty business, of course.
Nergal agreed. The escorts didn't object as long as some of them came along. They agreed to do it. So they spent the evening in the clammy, noisy submarine warehouse, Bly and his friends rummaging for equipment Nergal could use, and spent the night on short, narrow beds in Bly's boat, rocking as if in a big, clumsy cradle. The next morning, they puttered through a light mist the color of Mars, pinks and oranges floating this way and that over slack, glassy mauve water. The tide was near ebb, and the salvage crew and three of Nergal's escorts followed Bly's larger craft in a trio of small open motorboats maneuvering between chimney tops and traffic signs and power line poles, conferring frequently. Bly had gotten out a tattered book of maps, and he called out the street names of Sheerness, navigating to specific warehouses or shops. Many of the warehouses in the wharf area had already been salvaged, apparently, but there were more warehouses and shops scattered through the blocks of flats behind the seafront, and one of these was their morning's target.
"Here we go. 2 Carlton Lane."
It had been a jewelry store next to a small market.
"We'll try for jewels and canned food. A good balance, you might say."
They moored to the top of a billboard and stopped their engines. Bly threw a small object on a cord overboard, and he and 3 of the other men gathered around a small AI screen set on Bly's bridge dash. A thin cable paid out over the side, its reel creaking woefully. On the screen, the murky color image changed from brown to black to brown. "How do you know what you're seeing?" Nergal asked.
"We don't."
"But look, there's a door, see?"
"No."
Bly tapped a small keypad under the screen.
"In you go, thing. There. Now we're inside. This should be the market."
"Didn't they have time to get their things out?" Nergal asked.
"Not entirely. Everyone on the east coast of England had to move at once, almost, so there wasn't enough transport to take more than what you could carry in your car. If that, a lot of people left their homes intact, so we pulled the stuff worth pulling."
"What about the owners?"
"Oh, there's a register. We contact the register and find people when we can, and charge them a salvage fee if they want the stuff. If they're not on the register, we sell it on the island. People are wanting furniture and such. Here, look. We'll see what that is."
He pushed a key and the screen got brighter.
"Ah, yeah. Refrigerator. We could use it, but it's hell getting it up."
"What about the house?"
"Oh, we blow that up. Clean shot if we set the charges right. But not this morning. We'll tag this and move on."
They puttered away. Bly and another man continued to watch the screen, arguing mildly about where to go next.
"This town wasn't much even before the flood,"
Bly explained to Nergal.
"Fallen into the drink for a couple of 100 years. Ever since the Empire ended."
"Since the end of sail, you mean?"
the other man said.
"Same thing. The old Thames was used less and less after that, and all the little ports on the estuary began to go seedy. And that was a long time ago."
Finally, Bly killed the engine, looked at the others. In their whiskery faces, Nergal saw a curious mix of grim resignation and happy anticipation.
"There, then."
The other men started getting out underwater gear. Full wetsuits, tanks, face masks, some full helmets.
"We thought Eric's'd fit you," Bly said. "He was a giant."
He pulled a long black wetsuit out of the crowded locker, one without feet or gloves, and only a hood and face mask rather than a complete helmet.
"There's booties of his, too."
"Let me try them on." So he and 2 of the men took off their clothes and pulled on the wetsuits, sweating and puffing as they yanked the fabrics on and zipped up the tight collars. Nergal's wetsuit turned out to have a triangular rip across the left side of the torso, which was lucky, as otherwise it might not have fit. It was very tight around the chest, though loose on his legs. One of the other divers named Kev taped up the V-split with duct tape.
That'll be all right then, for one dive anyway. But you see what happened to Eric, eh?
Tapping him on the side.
See, you don't get caught up in any of our cable.
I will. Nergal felt his flesh crawl under the taped rip, which suddenly felt huge. Caught up on a moving cable, pulled into concrete or metal. Kah! What an agony. A fatal blow. How long would he have stayed conscious after that? A minute? Two? Rolling in agony, in the dark. He pulled himself out of an intense recreation of Eric's end, feeling shaken. They got a breathing rig attached to his upper arm and face mask, and abruptly he was breathing cold, dry air. Pure oxygen, they said. Bly asked again about going down as Nergal was shivering slightly.
No, no, said Nergal. I'm good with cold. This water isn't that cold. Besides, I've already filled the suit with sweat.
The other divers nodded, sweating themselves. Getting ready was hard work. The actual swimming was easier. Down a ladder and, ah yes, out of the crush of the G into something very like Martian G or lighter still. Such a relief. Nergal breathed in the cold bottled oxygen happily, almost weeping at the sudden freedom of his body, floating down through a comfortable dimness. Ah, yes. His world on Earth was underwater. Down deeper, things were as dark and amorphous as they had been on the screen, except for within the cones of light emanating from the other two men's headlamps, which were obviously very strong. Nergal followed above and behind them, getting the best view of all. The estuary water was cool, about 285K, Nergal judged, but very little of it seeped in at the wrists and around the hood, and the water trapped inside the suit was soon so hot with his exertions that his cold hands and face, and left ribs, actually served to keep him from overheating. The two cones of light shot this way and that as the two divers looked around. They were swimming along a narrow street. Seeing the buildings and the curbs, the sidewalks and streets, made the murky gray water look uncannily like the mist up on the surface. Then they were floating before a three-story brick building, filling a narrow triangular space that pointed into an angled intersection of streets. Kev gestured for Nergal to stay outside, and Nergal was happy to oblige. The other diver had been holding a cable so thin it was scarcely visible, and now he swam into a doorway, pulling it behind him. He went to work attaching a small pulley to the doorway and lining the cable through it. Time passed. Nergal swam slowly around the wedge-shaped building, looking in second-story windows at offices, empty rooms, flats. Some furniture floated against the ceilings. A movement inside one of these rooms caused him to jerk away. He was afraid of the cable. But it was on the other side of the building. Some water seeped into his mouthpiece, and he swallowed it to get it out of the way. It tasted of salt and mud and plant life, and something unpleasant. He swam on. Back at the doorway, Kev and the other man were helping a small metal safe through the doorway. When it was clear, they kicked upright, in place, waiting until the cable rose almost directly overhead. Then they swam around the intersection like a clumsy ballet team, and the safe floated up to the surface and disappeared. Kev swam back inside and came out kicking hard, holding two small bags. Nergal kicked over and took one, and with big, luxurious kicks, pulsed up toward the boat. He surfaced into the bright light of the mist. He would have loved to go back down, but Bly didn't want them in any longer, and so Nergal threw his fins in the boat and climbed the ladder over the side. He was sweating as he sat on one bench, and it was a relief to strip the hood off his head, despite the way his hair was yanked back. The clammy air felt good against his skin as they helped him peel the wetsuit off.
Look at his chest, will you? He's like a greyhound. Breathing vapors all his life.
The mist almost cleared, dissipating to reveal a white sky, the sun a brighter white swath across it. The weight had come back into him, and he breathed deeply a few times to get his body back into that work rhythm. His stomach was queasy, and his lungs hurt a little at the peak of each inhalation. Things rocked a bit more than the slosh of the ocean surface would account for. The sky turned to zinc, the sun's quadrant a harsh, blinding glare. Nergal stayed sitting, breathed faster and shallower.
"Did you like it?"
"Yes," he said. "I wish it felt like that everywhere." They laughed at the thought.
"Here, have a cup."
Perhaps going underwater had been a mistake. After that, the G never felt right again. It was hard to breathe. The air down in the warehouse was so wet that he felt he could clench a fist and drink water from his hand. His throat hurt, and his lungs. He drank cup after cup of tea, and still he was thirsty. The gleaming walls dripped, and nothing the people said was comprehensible. It was all I and eh and lore and da. Nothing like Martian English. A different language. Now they all spoke different languages. Shakespeare's plays hadn't prepared him for it. He slept again in the little bed on Bly's boat. The next day the escort gave the okay, and they motored out of Sheerness and north across the Thames estuary in a pink mist even thicker than the day before. Out in the estuary there was nothing visible but mist and the sea. Nergal had been in clouds before, especially on the west slope of Tharsis, where fronts ran up the rise of the bulge, but never, of course, while on water. And every time before, the temperatures had been well below freezing, the clouds a kind of flying snow, very white and dry and fine, rolling over the land and coating it with white dust. Nothing at all like this liquid world, where there was very little difference between the choppy water and the mist gusting over it, the liquid and the gaseous phasing back and forth endlessly. The boat rocked in a violent, irregular rhythm. Dark objects appeared in the margins of the mist, but Bly paid them no attention, keeping a sharp eye ahead through a window beaded with water to the point of opacity, and also watching a number of screens under the window. Suddenly Bly killed the engine, and the boat's rocking changed to a vicious side-to-side yaw. Nergal held the side of the cabin and peered through the watery window, trying to see what had caused Bly to stop.
"That's a big ship for Southend,"
Bly remarked, motoring on very slowly. "Where?"
"Port beam."
He pointed to a screen, then off to the left. Nergal saw nothing. Bly brought them into a low, long pier, with many boats moored to it on both sides. The pier ran north through the mist to the town of Southend-on-Sea, which ran up and disappeared in the mist, covering a slope of buildings. A number of men greeted Bly.
"Lovely day, eh? Brilliant."
And began to unload boxes from his hold. Bly inquired about the Asian woman from Vlissinga, but the men shook their heads.
"The Jap? She ain't here, mate." "They're saying in Sheerness she and her group came to Southend." "Why would they say that?" "Because that's what they think happened. That's what you get listening to people who live underwater." "The Packy Grandma?"
they said at the diesel fuel pump on the other side of the pier.
"She went over to Shoeburyness some time back."
Bly glanced at Nergal.
"It's just a few miles east. If she were here, these men would know."
"Let's try it then," Nergal said. So after refueling, they left the pier and puttered east through the mist. From time to time, the building-covered hillside was visible to their left. They rounded a point, turned north. Bly brought them in to another floating dock with many fewer boats than had been moored at Southend Pier.
"That Chinese gang," a toothless old man cried. "Gone up to Pig's Bay, they have. Gave us a greenhouse. Some kind of church.
Pig's Bay is just the next pier, Bly said, looking thoughtful as he wheeled them away from the dock. So they motored north. The coastline here was entirely composed of drowned buildings. They had built so close to the sea. Clearly, there had been no reason to fear any change in sea level. And then it happened. And now this strange amphibious zone, an intertidal civilization, wet and rocking in the mist. A cluster of buildings gleamed at their windows. They had been filled by the clear bubble material, pumped out and occupied, their upstairs just above the foamy waves, their downstairs just below. Bly brought the boat in to a set of linked floating docks, greeted a group of women in smocks and yellow rain slickers mending a big black net. He cut his engine.
Has the Asian lady been to see you too, then?
Oh, yeah. She's down inside. There, in the building at the end.
Nergal felt his pulse jarring through him. His balance had left him. He had to hold on to the rail. Over the side, onto the dock, down to the last building, a seafront boarding house or something like, now much broken up and glimmering in all the cracks, air inside, filled by a bubble. Green plants, vague and blurry, seen through sloshing gray water. He had a hand on Bly's shoulder. The little man led him in a door and down narrow stairs into a room with one whole wall exposed to the sea like a dirty aquarium. A diminutive woman in a rust-colored jumpsuit came through the far door, white-haired, black-eyed, quick and precise, bird-like. Not Hiroko. She stared at them.
"Are you the one who came over from Vlissinger?"
Bly asked after glancing up at Nergal.
The one that's been building these submariners?
Yes, the woman said. May I help you?
She had a high voice, a British accent. She stared at Nergal without expression. There were other people in the room, more coming in. She looked like the face he had seen in the cliffside in Medusa Vallis. Perhaps there was another Hiroko, a different one, wandering the two planets, building things. Nergal shook his head. The air was like a greenhouse gone bad, the light so dim. He could barely get back up the stairs. Bly had made their farewells. Back into the bright mist, back onto the boat, chasing wisps, a ruse to get him out of burn. Or an honest mistake. Or a simple fool's errand. Bly sat him down in the boat's cabin next to a rail.
Oh, well.
Pitching and yawing through the mist which closed back down. Dark, dim day on the water, sloshing through the phase change where water and mist turned into each other, sandwiched between them. Nergal got a little drowsy. No doubt she was back on Mars. Doing her work there in her usual secrecy, yes. It had been absurd to think otherwise. When he got back, he would find her. Yes, it was a goal, a task he gave himself. He would find her and make her come out into the open. Make sure she had survived. It was the only way to be sure, the only way to remove this horrible weight from his heart. Yes, he would find her. Then, as they motored on over the choppy water, the mist lifted. Low gray clouds rushed overhead, dropping swirls of rain into the waves. The tide was ebbing now, and as they crossed the great estuary, the flow of the Thames was released full force. The gray-brown surface of the water was broken to mush, waves coming from all directions at once, a wild, bouncing surface of foamy, dark water, all carried rapidly east, out into the North Sea. And then the wind turned and poured over the tide, and all the waves were suddenly rushing out to sea together. Among the long cakes of foam were floating objects of all kinds, boxes, furniture, roofs, entire houses, capsized boats, pieces of wood, flotsam and jetsam. Bly's crew stood on the deck, leaning over the rails with grapnels and binoculars, calling back to him to avoid things or to try to approach them. They were absorbed in the work.
"What is all this stuff?" Nergal asked Bly.
"It's London," Bly said. "It's fucking London. Washing out to sea."
The cloud bottoms rushed east over their heads. Looking around, Nergal saw many other small boats on the tossing water of the great river mouth, salvaging the flotsam or just fishing. Bly waved to some as they passed through, tooted at others. Horn blasts floated on the wind over the gray-speckled estuary, apparently signaling messages as Bly's crews commented on each. Then Kev exclaimed,
"Hey, what's that now?"
pointing upstream. Out of a fog bank covering the mouth of the Thames had emerged a ship with sails, many sails. Sails square-rigged on three masts in the archetypal configuration, deeply familiar to Nergal, even though he had never seen it before. A chorus of horn blasts greeted this apparition. Mad toots, long sustained blasts, all joining together and sustaining longer and longer, like a neighborhood of dogs roused and baying at night, warming to their task. Above them exploded the sharp, penetrating blast of Bly's air horn, joining the chorus. Nergal had never heard such a shattering sound. It hurt his ears. Thicker air, denser sound. Bly was grinning, his fist shoved against the air horn button. The men of the crew all standing at the rail or on it, Nergal's escorts as well, screaming soundlessly at the sudden vision. Finally, Bly let off.
"What is it?" Nergal shouted.
"It's the Kaisok," Bly said,
and threw his head back and laughed.
"It was bolted down in Greenwich, stuck in a park. Some mad bastards must have liberated it. What a brilliant idea. They must have towed it around the flood barrier. Look at her sail."
The old clipper ship had four or five sails unfurled on each of the three masts, and a few triangular ones between the masts as well, and extending forward to the bowsprit. It was sailing in the midst of the ebb flow, and there was a strong wind behind it, so that it sliced through the foam and flotsam, splitting water away from its sharp bow in a quick succession of white waves. There were men standing in its rigging, Nergal saw, most of them out leaning over the yardarms, waving one-armed at the ragged flotilla of motorboats as they passed through it. Pennants extended from the mast tops, a big blue flag with red crosses. When it came abreast of Bly's boat, Bly hit the air horn trigger again and again, and the men roared. A sailor out at the end of the Cutty Sark's mainsail yard waved at them with both hands, leaning his chest forward against the big polished cylinder of wood. Then he lost his balance. They all saw it happen, as if in slow motion. And with his mouth a round little O, the sailor fell backward, dropping into the white water that foamed away from the ship's side. The men on Bly's boat shouted all together, "No!" Bly cursed loudly and gunned his engine, which was suddenly loud in the absence of the air horn. The rear of the boat dug deep into the water, and then they were grumbling toward the man overboard, now one black dot among the rest, a raised arm waving frantically. Boats everywhere were tooting, honking, blasting their horns, but the Cutty Sark never slowed. It sailed away at full speed, sails all taut-bellied when seen from behind, a beautiful sight. By the time they reached the fallen sailor, the stern of the clipper was low on the water to the east, its masts a cluster of white sail and black rigging, until it disappeared abruptly into another wall of mist.
"What a glorious sight!"
one of the men was still repeating.
"What a glorious sight! Yeah, yeah, glorious. Here, fish this poor bastard in."
Bly threw the engine in reverse, then idled. They threw a ladder over the side, leaned over to help the wet sailor up the steps. Finally, he made it over the rail, stood bent over in his soaking clothes, holding on to the rail, shivering.
"Oh, thanks," he said between retches over the side.
Kev and the other crew members got his wet clothes off him, wrapped him in thick, dirty blankets.
"You're a stupid fucking idiot!"
Bly shouted down from the wheelhouse.
"There you were about to sail the world in the Cutty Sark, and now here you are on the Bride of Faversham. You're a stupid fucking idiot!"
"I know,"
the man said between retches. The men threw jackets over his back, laughing.
"Silly fool, waving at us like that."
All the way back to Sheerness, they proclaimed his ineptitude while getting the bereft man dried and into the wind protection of the wheelhouse, dressed in spare clothes much too small for him. He laughed with them, cursed his luck, described the fall, reenacted coming loose. Back in Sheerness, they helped him down into the submerged warehouse and fed him hot stew and pint after pint of bitter beer, meanwhile telling the people inside and everyone who came down the ladder all about his fall from grace.
"Look here, this silly wanker fell off the Cutty Sark this afternoon, the clumsy bastard, when it was running down the tide under full sail to Tahiti."
"To Pitcairn," Bly corrected.
The sailor himself, extremely drunk, told his tale as often as his rescuers.
"Just took my hands off for a second, and it gave a little lurch, and I was flying. Flying in space. Didn't think it would matter, I didn't. Took my hands off all the time up the Thames. Oh, one more here. Excuse me, I've got to spew." Oh, God, she was a glorious sight, she was. Brilliant, really. More sail than they needed, of course. It was just to go out in style, but God bless him for that. Such a sight.
Nergal felt dizzy and bleak. The whole big room had gone a glossy dark except in the exact spots where there were streaks of bright glare. Everything a chiaroscuro of jumbled objects, Bruegel in black and white, and so loud.
"I remember the spring flood of 13. The North Sea in me living room." "Ah, no, not the flood of 13 again. Will you not go on about that again?"
He went to a partitioned room at one corner of the chamber, the men's room, thinking he would feel better if he relieved himself. Inside, the rescued sailor was on the floor of one of the stalls, retching violently. Nergal retreated, sat down on the nearest bench to wait. A young woman passed him by and reached out to touch him on the top of the head.
"You're hot."
Nergal held the palm to his forehead, tried to think about it. 310K, he ventured.
"Shit." "You've caught a fever," she said.
One of his bodyguards sat beside him. Nergal told him about his temperature, and the man said,
"Will you ask your wrist pad?"
Nergal nodded, asked for a readout. 309K.
"Shit. How do you feel?"
"Hot, heavy.
We'd better get you to see someone."
Nergal shook his head, but a wave of dizziness came over him as he did. He watched the bodyguards calling to make arrangements. Bly came over, and they asked him questions.
"At night?" Bly said.
More quiet talk. Bly shrugged. "Not a good idea," the shrug said, "but possible." The bodyguards went on, and Bly tossed down the last of his pint and stood. His head was still at the same level as Nergal's, although Nergal had slid down to rest his back against the table. A different species, a squat, powerful amphibian. Had they known that before the flood? Did they know it now? People said goodbye, crushed or coddled his hand. Climbing the conning tower ladder was painful work. Then they were out in the cool, wet night, fog shrouding everything. Without a word, Bly led them onto his boat, and he remained silent as he started the engines and unmoored the boat. Off they puttered over a low swell. For the first time, the rocking over the waves made Nergal really queasy. Nausea was worse than pain. He sat down beside Bly on a stool and watched the gray cone of illuminated water and fog before their bow. When dark objects loomed out of the fog, Bly would slow, even shove the engines into reverse. Once he hissed. This went on for a long time. By the time they docked in the streets of Faversham, Nergal was too sick to say goodbye properly. He could only grasp Bly's hand and look down briefly into the man's blue eyes. Such faces! You could see people's souls right there in their faces. Had they known that before? Then Bly was gone, and they were in a car humming through the night. Nergal's weight was increasing as it had during the descent in the elevator. Onto a plane, ascending in darkness, descending in darkness, ears popping painfully. Nausea. They were in Bern, and Sax was there by his side, a great comfort. He was in a bed, very hot, his breathing wet and painful. Out one window, the Alps. The white breaking up out of the green, like death itself rearing up out of life, crashing through to remind him that Veriditas was a green fuse that would someday explode back into nova whiteness, returning to the same array of elements it had been before the pattern dust devil had picked it up. The white and the green. It felt like the Jungfrau was shoving up his throat. He wanted to sleep, to get away from that feeling. Sax sat at his side, holding his hand. "I think he needs to be in Martian gravity," he was saying to someone who didn't seem to be in the room. "It could be a form of altitude sickness, or a disease vector, or allergies. A systemic response. Edema, anyway. Let's take him up immediately in a ground-to-space plane and get him into a G-ring at Martian G. If I'm right, it will help. If not, it won't hurt." Nergal tried to speak but couldn't catch his breath. This world had infected him, crushed him, cooked him in steam and bacteria. A blow to the ribs. He was allergic to Earth. He squeezed Sax's hand, pulled in a breath like a knife to the heart. "Yes," he gasped, and saw Sax squint. "Home. Yes." Part 5. Home at Last. An old man sitting at sickbed. Hospital rooms are all the same. Clean, white, cool, humming, fluorescent. On the sick bed lies a man, tall, dark-skinned, thick black eyebrows, sleeping fitfully. The old man is hunched at his head. One finger touches the skull behind the ear. Under his breath, the old man is muttering, "If it's an allergic response, then your own immune system has to be convinced that the allergen isn't really a problem. They haven't identified an allergen. Pulmonary edema is usually high-altitude sickness, but maybe the mix of gases caused it, or maybe it was low-altitude sickness. You need to get water out of your lungs. They've done pretty well with that. The fever and chills might be amenable to biofeedback. A really high fever is dangerous. You must remember that. I remember the time you came into the baths after falling into the lake. You were blue." Jackie jumped right in. No. Maybe she stopped to watch. "You held Hiroko and me by the arms, and we all saw you warm up. Non-shivering thermogenesis. Everyone does it. But you did it voluntarily. And very powerfully as well. I've never seen anything like it. I still don't know how you did it. You were a wonderful boy. People can shiver at will if they want, so maybe it's like that, only inside. It doesn't really matter. You don't need to know how. You just need to do it. If you can do it in the other direction, bring your temperature down. Give it a try. Give it a try. You were such a wonderful boy." The old man reaches out and grabs the young man by the wrist. He holds it and squeezes.
You used to ask questions. You were very curious, very good-natured. You would say, why, Sax, why? Why, Sax, why? It was fun to try to keep answering.
The world is like a tree. From every leaf, you can work back to the roots. I'm sure Hiroko felt that way. She probably was the one who first told me that.
Listen, it wasn't a bad thing to go looking for Hiroko. I've done the same thing myself. I will again, because I saw her once, on Didelia. She helped me when I got caught out in a storm. She held my wrist, just like this. She's alive, Nirgal. Hiroko is alive. She's out there. You'll find her someday.
Put that internal thermostat to work. Get that temperature down, and someday you'll find her.
The old man lets go of the wrist. He slumps over, half asleep, muttering still.
You would say, why, Sax? Why?
If the Mistral hadn't been blowing, he might have cried, for nothing looked the same. Nothing. He came into a Marseille train station that hadn't existed when he left, next to a little new town that hadn't existed when he left, and all of it built according to a dripping, bulbous Gaudi architecture which also had a kind of Bogdanovist circularity to it, so that Michel was reminded of Christianopolis or Hiranyagarbha, if they had melted. No, nothing looked familiar in the slightest. The land was strangely flattened, green, deprived of its rock, deprived of that je ne sais quoi that had made it Provence. He had been gone 102 years. But blowing over all this unfamiliar landscape was the Mistral, pouring down off the Massif Central, cold, dry, musty and electric, flushed with negative ions or whatever it was that gave it its characteristic katabatic exhilaration. The Mistral. No matter what it looked like, it had to be Provence.
This ends side one of cassette 7. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.